Good morning. Welcome to Inquisition Update. My name's Tom Press, and I'll be your host for the next hour. You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. As like myself, I hope you're all interested in this book and anxious to resume our reading and discussion of it. The book is entitled A Woman Rides the Beast. It's by Dave Hunt. It's a rather dated book written back in the 80s, but still, I want my listeners to recognize what Dave Hunt is saying in his book and compare what he's saying with all the previous authors that we've read here on Inquisition Update and see if you can come up with any schism among them. They all say the same thing. And I hope the message is getting through to my listeners. But there is no need to look anywhere but the papacy, either in history or the present or the future, for Antichrist. And Dave Hunt says it as well as anyone, and except for his futurism, I agree with him. He's consistent with all the other authors and historians that we've read over the past 7 or so years here on Inquisition Update. And for the new listeners tuning in, you can subscribe to the archives and gain access to all those previous books and assess this matter for yourselves, and I highly recommend that you do. Now, we're going to retreat as typical, a paragraph or two for continuity purposes this morning. We'll begin reading the first full paragraph on page 88 of the book. We're in the title in chapter, we're in the chapter entitled Fraud and Fabricated History. And Dave Hunt says, the typical Roman Catholic, though he may disagree with his church on such issues as homosexuality, abortion, extramarital sex, contraceptives, and the necessity for confession, nevertheless believes that when it comes time for him to die, Rome holds his only hope. The Roman Catholic Church holds his only hope. In other words, his membership of the Roman Catholic Church is his salvation. Now, the Pope, as Christ's vicar, as they say, gives a visible reality and practical expression to that hope. The extraordinary position of the Pope in relation to members of the Roman Catholic Church was expressed succinctly in Rome's La Civiltà Cattolica, the official organ of the Roman Catholic Church, which a papal brief described in the 19th century as, quote, the purest journalistic organ of true Roman Catholic doctrine. Okay? So this quote taken from Civiltà Cattolica, this periodical issued by the Roman Catholic Church, is the most pristine representation of the teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. It says, quote, it is not enough for people only to know that the Pope is the head of the Church. They must also understand that their own faith and religious life flow from him, that in him is the bond which unites Catholics to one another and the power which strengthens and the light which guides them, that he is the dispenser of spiritual graces, the giver of benefits of religion, the upholder of justice, and the protector of the oppressed, unquote. Now, wouldn't you regard that as blasphemy? That's exactly what it is. That's the official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church, seen in its most pristine representation, La Civiltà Cattolica. Now, resuming where we left off yesterday, Dave concludes this portion of the chapter by saying, similar words have been spoken by the followers of Joseph Smith, Sun Myung Moon, and other cult leaders. The Pope is, quote, another Christ, unquote, and, quote, God on earth, unquote, to his followers. And as Vatican Council II says, he can be judged by neither man nor tribunal. The official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. It's the world's biggest cult and its leader is Satan himself. Now, this reminds me of an incident that took place back during the Waco tragedy. The whole world had been informed that David Koresh and the Branch Davidians represented a cult. Okay? The point here is not to assess whether or not they were a cult, but what's important is that Attorney General Janet Reno, in her testimony before Congress, laid forth all the characteristics of a cult as she defined them. Now, this, she went through all of the tenets of a cult. That it has a supreme leader, that he commands unthinking obedience, that he is supreme authority, and that he is worshipped as a god, and on and on and on it went. Janet Reno, the Attorney General of the United States, defining what a cult was. And as I listened, virtually every tenet of what she described as a cult perfectly described the Roman Catholic Church. It is indeed the biggest cult on the planet, by Janet Reno's own definition. Now, Dave Hunt continues with this chapter, and in the subtitled, Check Your Mind at the Door. That's what's expected of you as a Roman Catholic. And that's what's being more and more expected of you as a non-Roman Catholic in this country, no matter what denomination you belong to. He says the Pope, and therefore the Church through him as its head, both claim to be infallible. Ordinary Catholics must not question anything the Pope or the Church have to say concerning faith and morals. The councils and the catechisms has for centuries declared the need for such total submission and still insist upon it today. The Catholic World, another Roman Catholic publication, reminded all Roman Catholics in the United States at the time of the First Vatican Council, that was 1870, quote, each individual must receive the faith and law from the Church. With unquestioning submission and obedience of the intellect and the will, we have no right to ask reasons of the Church any more than of Almighty God. We are to take with unquestioning docility whatever instruction the Church gives us. Unquote. Perfect definition of a cult, isn't it? Check your brain and your Bible and your conscience along with your coat at the door. Just come in, sit down, shut up, believe, do, think, and acquiesce in every tenet to whatever the Roman Catholic Church teaches you. Whatever the Pope teaches you, because he is the Church. He is, as it were, Christ on earth, Christ hidden under a veil of flesh. That's the official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. Here we have as clear a denial of individual moral responsibility as can be found in any cult. Okay? You have no conscience of your own. You have no will of your own. You have no thought of your own. You may not read and interpret the scriptures on your own. You must have no moral responsibility at all within yourself. You must be responsible to the Pope, a mindless cadaver, simply moved about as the Pope wishes. You must think, do, and say, and believe everything that is taught to you by the Church, if you wish to remain in fellowship with the Church, outside of which there is no salvation. Again, he says, here we have as clear a denial of individual moral responsibility as can be found in any cult. I want to ask my listeners, when you're standing before Christ at the judgment seat, will the Church, the Roman Catholic Church, or the Pope, or the councils, or the anything stand between you and Christ at that judgment? Clearly, this is a cult. as defined by even the one who was believed qualified to define a cult. He says the same requirement of unthinking submission is demanded in Vatican Council II. The Code of Canon Law likewise reasserts the same rule. Quote, the Christian faithful, and that includes Protestants by Rome's definition, the Christian faithful, conscious of their own responsibility, are bound by Christian obedience to follow what the sacred pastors, as representatives of Christ, declare as teachers of the faith or determine as leaders of the church. Unquote. So you must not do what God says, you must do what men say. And they are indeed, despite their blasphemies, merely men. And worse than that, most diabolical men. Now it says, when it comes to faith and morals and the way to salvation, Roman Catholics must check their minds at the door and accept whatever the Roman Catholic Church says. They can't even study the Bible for themselves because only the magisterium can interpret it. That is, between the Pope and his cardinals. They are the ones who read and interpret and teach the scriptures. No one may believe otherwise than what they teach. It's called the magisterium, the official teaching authority of the Roman Catholic Church. Obviously, this prohibition against freedom of conscience is related to the total suppression of basic human rights for all mankind everywhere, which is the unchanging goal of Roman Catholicism. That's the New World Order. Total suppression of basic human rights for all mankind everywhere. That has always been the unchanging goal of Roman Catholicism. A return to the old world order. That is the new world order. No thought or will of your own. No conscience of your own. You may not read the Bible for yourself. You may not pray and ask for divine revelation. You must take your beliefs directly from the church. Now, to understand Roman Catholicism, one must ignore the public posturing and the public relations-motivated profile offered by the Roman Catholic Church. In other words, she is not what she appears to be. You have to peer behind the veil to find out what Roman Catholicism really is, and that veil is only pierced by observing her activities throughout history. The face that Rome shows to the world, writes Dave Hunt, varies from country to country, depending upon the control that it has and what it can effect. Instead, we must look to Catholicism's official doctrines, which never change. Vatican Council II is thought by most Catholics and non-Catholics to have liberalized Catholicism. In other words, made them more like Protestantism. Do not be mistaken. In fact, says Dave Hunt, it reaffirmed the canons and decrees of previous key Roman Catholic councils. Quote, this sacred council accepts loyally the venerable faith of our ancestors, and it proposes again the decrees of the Second Council of Nicaea, of the Council of Florence, and of the Council of Trent. Unquote. So Vatican Council II, for all of its apparent liberalities, reaffirmed at the end of that council that nothing that was said or done at Vatican Council II conflicted with anything that the Roman Catholic Church had determined throughout its history. And we take particular notice of what it refers to here as the Council of Trent. And Dave Hunt continues, he says, the Council of Trent denounced the Protestant Reformation and damned evangelicals' beliefs with more than 100 anathemas. So Vatican Council II, while it appeared to roll out the red carpet of return, the yellow carpet, out to the evangelicals, it was simply a surrender. It reaffirmed the Vatican Council of Trent. and all of its anathemas against evangelicals. And while they publicly called them separated brethren as a gesture of reconciliation, in actual fact, the Roman Catholic Church still regards them as heretics and those who have waffled on their Protestant beliefs and have now been forced to go back to the Roman Catholic Church. And it bears repeating. I know my regular listeners will probably roll their eyes, but look, after three or four generations of being taught that the Pope is, that the Antichrist is a single individual that doesn't arrive on the Christian scene until 7 years before Christ returns, simply renders the entire Protestant Reformation an error. And the papacy recognizes that now. By their own words, those who once called themselves Protestants are no longer Protestant anymore. They no longer see the papacy as the Antichrist of the Bible. And therefore, they have repudiated the Protestant Reformation, and by law, by Roman Catholic canon law, they are heretics and obstinate heretics, and the sentence has already been issued against heretics. And the grace period began with Vatican Council II. You come back to the church, you've got so much time to come back to the Roman Catholic Church. And after that, with our new political mandate that we now wield in Washington, D.C., we're going to begin government-sponsored religious persecution against those who will not conform to the Roman Catholic religion. That's what's going to happen in this country. Trust me, that's what's going to happen. Or history is a liar. The Bible is a liar. God's people are going to be persecuted in this country, and this persecution has been brought down upon us because of the repudiation of the Protestant Reformation by believing in futurism, dispensational futurism, the twisting of Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, and changing the identity of the subject of that verse from Christ to Antichrist, which exonerates the papacy as Antichrist and puts it on a single individual. What a crafty way to destroy the Protestant Reformation. And it's a done deal, except for those holdouts like myself who have returned from futurism to the true knowledge of the Scripture, the true belief and support and attestation of the Protestant Reformation. And, I'm one of those against which all of these 100 anathemas of the Council of Trent have been levied. And I know that it's just a matter of time before the government of the United States silences my voice and every other voice like it in this country. And with what little time is left, I'm going to continue until God takes me home. Dave Hunt continues, he says, all these condemnations of the gospel of God's grace are endorsed and affirmed by Vatican Council II. As for the Pope, Vatican Council II clearly states, quote, remember this is an ecumenical council. The Pope speaks ex cathedra when he speaks to the whole church. Here's what he said at Vatican Council II. This is what all the evangelibellies have acquiesced to. Quote, the Roman pontiff, head of the College of Bishops, enjoys this infallibility in virtue of his office, that is, not in the holiness of his life. When, as supreme pastor and teacher of all the faithful, he proclaims as an absolute decision a doctrine pertaining to faith and morals. For that reason, his definitions are rightly said to be irreformable, in no way in need of approval by others, and do not admit of appeal to any other tribunal. That includes God's. The faithful, for their part, you evangelibellies, are obliged to submit to their bishop's decision made in the name of Christ in matters of faith and morals. and to adhere to it with a ready and respectful allegiance of mind. This loyal submission and of the will and the intellect, you must submit your will and your intellect. It must be given in a special way to the authentic teaching authority of the Roman pontiff, even when he does not speak ex cathedra in such wise. Indeed, that his supreme teaching authority be acknowledged with respect, and that one sincerely adhere to decisions made by him conformably with his manifest mind and intention. Unquote. So there's what you got when you went to Vatican Council II and signed your documents of capitulation to the biblical, historical, and prophetic Antichrist. You must conform your every thought, will, and deed, your conscience, even your intentions, to the authority and the official teaching of the pontiff, the supreme pontiff, God on earth, the Pope, the biblical, historical, and prophetic Antichrist. You have the mark of the beast on you. You will take part in her deeds, and you will surely suffer her plagues, just as is said in Revelation 18, verses 4 and 5. Now, Dave Hunt says, obliged to submit to their bishop's decision, submission of the will and the intellect must be given. That gives Rome incredible power over devout Catholics. That every Roman Catholic does not obey is not the point. The point is that such wording is the unchangeable teaching and intent of the Church, not only for its members, but for all mankind. Okay, so that takes away any protection that I may assume for myself, being an obstinate heretic, being a true Protestant. The Pope says I must conform as well. Now, while Roman Catholics rebel against certain church doctrine, they remain nominally attached to the Church, though they may only attend on Christmas and Easter. When it comes, however, to the hope of someday being released from purgatory and getting into heaven, no Roman Catholic can question the Church, or he would cease to be under its protection and thus be damned. Vatican Council II clearly says, quote, this Holy Council teaches that the Church is necessary for salvation. Not Christ, the Church is necessary for salvation. Hence, they could not be saved who, knowing that the Roman Catholic Church was founded and as necessary by God through Christ, would refuse either to enter it or to remain in it. Okay? You've denied your salvation if you will not enter the Roman Catholic Church or if you will not remain in it. That's the teaching of the magisterium of the Antichrist Church of Rome. Now remember that Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini remained Roman Catholics to the end and were never excommunicated by the Roman Catholic Church. So did thousands of the worst Nazi criminals who ever lived, whom the Vatican smuggled out of Europe into safe havens in South America and even the United States. Rome has even canonized some of the most wicked human beings that ever lived on the planet. And we'll continue with the reading of this book when we get back from the break. A Woman Rides a Beast by Dave Hunt. Stay tuned. Thank you.
pledge allegiance to the King of Kings, and to his kingdom come, on earth as it is in heaven. One holy nation, and our Heavenly Father, grace, mercy, justice for all.
The program you are listening to is 100% sponsored by you, the listener, on this First Amendment Rights Media channel. You will notice that there are few commercials on this radio network. There's a good reason for that. Corporate advertising dollars come with strings that limit program content. So without your help, these programs cannot continue on internet or our several affiliates. If you benefit by the educational law programs, we ask you to give. If you are admonished or nurtured by the Bible and ministry programs, we ask you to give. If some voice a cause that you are passionate about, we ask you to give. If you believe in any of these, we ask you to support them as you would a missionary on a continual basis, as if giving a tithe for missionary radio. These programs are not commercially viable and must be supported by those faithful to the cause of truth. Look for the button to sponsor your favorite programs at our listen and schedule pages on the internet. Then, when you subscribe, we will send you the last quarterly MP3 CD of that program immediately, and continue to do so with each new quarter. We will also give you unlimited archive access to all of our programs. We're asking you to give much less than a tithe, so that you may also send support directly to a particular program host, cause, and anywhere else the Spirit may lead you. Do all to the glory of our God and Creator, for His holy nation, the only kingdom that will last forever. Thank you for listening.
Hi, Nicholas here. I used to lug those big jugs to the market to fill with water from those coin-operated filter machines, 25 cents a gallon or 5 gallons for a buck. I used to. Then I got the big Berkey. Now I saved my back and hundreds of dollars, too. I was paying $600 for the same 3,000 gallons of water that a pair of black Berkey filters will provide from my own tap for only $99. This means that your Berkey water system will entirely pay for itself with only 1,500 gallons of use. And then you will still have 1,500 gallons left before you need to replace the filters. Do the math. Stop throwing your money away on bottled water and filter dispensers that may or may not be delivering as promised. For a limited time, First Amendment Radio is offering 10% off on the most popular Berkey water systems. Visit the shopping page at firstamendmentradio.com or call us at 559-781-3773 for more information. Leave your name and address and we'll send you this special offer. Do it now. First Amendment Radio is an authorized distributor of Berkey products.
Welcome back from the break. You're listening to the second half hour of Inquisition Update on First Amendment Radio. If you'd like to support First Amendment, if you'd like to support Inquisition Update, please support First Amendment Radio, who sponsors the program. If you wish to contact me via email, please do so, tom@seawaves.us. tom@seawaves.us. Now, before the break, Dave Hunt said, remember that Hitler and Mussolini remained Catholics to the end and were never excommunicated from the Church. Roman Catholicism has within its ranks the most violent criminals of all history. This is not news to anybody who knows the history of the Roman Catholic Church. Some of the most venerated popes in the calendar of the popes are celebrated, canonized, made saints in the church, would put Hitler and Mussolini to shame for their bloodshed. It's not the Church of Jesus Christ, not by any stretch of the imagination. He says, remember that Hitler and Mussolini remained Catholics to the end and were never excommunicated by the Roman Catholic Church. So did thousands of the worst Nazi criminals whom the Vatican smuggled out of Europe with the help of the CIA of the United States, the Catholics in action in the United States, together with the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Inquisition, smuggled out of Europe these war criminals, these Nazis, and put them in safe havens in South America and right here in this country, some of the highest positions in science, mathematics, chemistry, right here in the United States of America. Could this really be a Protestant nation if that were the case? It was the case, but only because there was just no protest from the Protestants. He says, such arch criminals are honored with Roman Catholic funerals like mafia members. They die with the assurance that their church, the Roman Catholic Church, will continue to say masses in order to get them out of purgatory and eventually into heaven. It's an insurance policy that very few allow to lapse completely. And the point Dave Hunt is making here is that that wonderful Roman Catholic neighbor of yours that you think so highly of, you golf with him, you barbecue with him, you fish with him, you visit, drink tea on the patio with him. You may even go on vacations with him. Dearly love him, okay? He may say to you, well, I'm Roman Catholic, but I'm not a very good Roman Catholic. He may go to Mass either on Christmas or Easter, and outside of that, he really doesn't have much to do with the Roman Catholic Church. He's not real crazy about religion altogether, but trust me, he depends on his church for salvation. He depends, even though he is a nominal Roman Catholic at best, he depends on the papacy and the Roman Catholic Church to bail him out of purgatory, out of the writhing flames of purgatory so that he can go to heaven. And when push comes to shove, he's going to do whatever the Pope tells him to do. And if you think that's just speculation, stay tuned to Inquisition Update for a long period of time. We've proven this over and over and over throughout history. Even nominal Roman Catholics, when they're put to the knife, when they're put to the sword, when the rebellion or the Inquisition or the Crusade is ordered by the Pope, they become ravenous killers of Protestants. That's not hyperbole. That's history. Factual history. Every Roman Catholic is bound to his church as a matter of salvation. Many of them will play fast and loose with their lives. But when the Pope says go, they go. When the Pope says do, they do. And that's how they've overthrown kingdoms. That's how they've led crusades against God's true people throughout all of history. Literally soaked the earth with the blood of the saints and the martyrs of Jesus. Every one of them is a fifth column for the Pope. They need salvation. They need Jesus Christ. They need God's law to replace Roman Catholic canon law. They need true salvation. They need to be set free from the yoke of Romanism, from the yoke of Antichrist. They need to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that's what our job is. Now, under the subtitle Impeccability versus Infallibility, Dave says the required blind faith in the pronouncements of the Pope and the clergy seem to make sense because the Roman Catholic Church is the largest and the oldest. Surely so many billions of religious people couldn't be wrong for the past 1,500 years. Faith is also bolstered by the assurance that the Roman Catholic Church is the one true church, the one which alone can be traced back to the original apostles, and that its papal authority comes directly from Christ, through Peter by a long and unbroken line of apostolic succession. As proof, the Roman Catholic Church provides a list of its popes. Thus far, 263 upon the time of the writing of this book, all the way back to the Apostle Peter. Few Catholics know that popes quarreled and fought with one another, excommunicated one another, and sometimes even killed each other. It is difficult to find even a few among the popes after the 5th century who exhibited even the basic Christian virtues. Their lives, as recorded in the Catholic Encyclopedia, read like an unbelievable soap opera of lust, madness, mayhem, and murder. Nevertheless, all of these master criminals, poisoners, adulterers, and mass murderers are considered to have been infallible when they spoke ex cathedra, that is, made dogmatic pronouncements upon faith and morals to the whole church. Catholic apologists argue that there is a difference between impeccability, as they call it, impeccability in character and conduct, which the Pope certainly did not have, and infallibility in faith and morals, which every Catholic must believe they did have. What folly to believe that a man who in his life denies the faith and is habitually immoral is nevertheless infallible when he speaks of faith and morals. Knowledgeable Roman Catholics readily admit that many popes were incredibly evil, but that fact, it is argued, simply proves that they were human and allows one to disagree with them in good conscience. To the Catholic, it makes good sense that, in spite of the undeniable wickedness of her clergy, the Roman Catholic Church must be mankind's only hope. After all, it was established by Jesus Christ himself, who made Peter the first pope. That is supposedly proved by the Scripture, by the phrase, quote, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock will I build my church," unquote. Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, which we will deal with in detail later. Now, about an unknown dogma, Dave writes, contrary to what Roman Catholics are taught, the papal office did not originate with Peter. It was centuries before the Bishop of Rome attempted to dominate the rest of the church, and many centuries before his primacy was generally accepted. Leo the Great's letter to Flavian in 449 AD was not accepted until the Council of Chalcedon had approved it. He says, Pope Leo I himself acknowledged that his treatise could not become the rule of faith until it was confirmed by the bishops, plural, unquote. There were 8 councils of the Roman Catholic Church before the Schism of 1054 split it into Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy. When the Bishop of Rome and the Patriarch of Constantinople excommunicated each other, none of these 8 councils was called by the Bishop of Rome, but by the Emperor, who also put his stamp of approval upon their decrees. As for papal authority, one Catholic historian reminds us, quote, Pope Pelagius, who reigned from 556 to 560 A.D., talks of heretics separating themselves from the apostolic sees, that is, Rome, Jerusalem, Alexandria, plus Constantinople. In all the early writings of the hierarchy, there's no mention of a special role for the Bishop of Rome, nor yet the special name of Pope. Of the 80 or so heresies in the first 6 centuries, not one refers to the authority of the Bishop of Rome. Not one is settled by the Bishop of Rome. No one attacks the supreme authority of the Roman Pontiff because no one has even heard of it, unquote. That's the writing of Pope Pelagius of 556 to 560 A.D. No one's even heard of it. The Easter Synod of 680, called by Pope Agatho, was the first ecclesiastical body that asserted the primacy of Rome over the rest of the church. But this was not an ecumenical council of the entire church, so its decision was not generally accepted. As Catholic historian Peter de Rosa points out, quote, "Not one of the early fathers of the church saw in the Bible any reference to papal jurisdiction over the church. On the contrary, they take it for granted that bishops, especially metropolitans, have the full right to govern and administer their own territory without interference from anyone. The Eastern Church never accepted primal supremacy. Rome's attempt to impose it led to the schism. One looks in vain in the first millennium for a single doctrine or piece of legislation imposed by Rome alone on the rest of the church. The only general laws came out of the councils, such as Nicaea. In any case, how could the Bishop of Rome have exercised universal jurisdiction in those early centuries when there was no Roman Curia, when other bishops brooked no interference in their dioceses from anyone, when Rome issued no dispensations and demanded no tribute or taxation, when all bishops, not just the Bishop of Rome, had the power to bind and to loose, when no bishop or church or individual was censured by Rome. Further, for centuries, the Bishop of Rome was chosen by the local citizens, clergy, and laity. If he had jurisdiction over the universal church, would not the rest of the world want a say in his appointment? When he was believed to have universal supremacy, the rest of the church did demand a say in his election. This came about only in the Middle Ages." Unquote. Now, we read Peter de Rosa's book in entirety here on Inquisition Update, Vicars of Christ, The Dark Side of the Papacy, and I highly recommend you get a copy of that book and read it for yourself and keep it and show it to others. There's no justification at all for any claim of authority by the Pope over God's people. No justification whatsoever. No historical, no biblical, no nothing. Now, subtitled "From Calvary to Regal Pontiff," Dave Hunt writes, "It requires ingenious interpolation to derive from the simple statement, quote, 'On this rock I will build my church,' unquote, that a patron office, apostolic succession, papal infallibility, and all the pomp, ceremony, and power surrounding the Pope today was started. As one Catholic writer rather sarcastically points out, quote, 'It required great skill to take statements made by a poor carpenter to an equally poor fisherman to apply them to a regal pontiff who was soon to be called Lord of the World.'" Unquote. Yet, such is the only biblical foundation upon which the entire superstructure of the Roman Catholic Church has been built. It includes an infallible pope, apostolic succession, an intricate hierarchy of priests, bishops, archbishops, cardinals, et al., the magisterium of bishops, which alone can interpret the Bible, the requirement that for his alleged infallibility, the Pope must speak ex cathedra to the entire church on matters of faith and morals, etc., etc. All of this is built on that simple phrase, "On this rock I will build my church." Quite an extrapolation, isn't it? He says that none of these concepts is even remotely suggested, much less specifically stated, either in Matthew 16:18 or elsewhere in Scripture, is dismissed by Catholic apologists who then look to tradition for support. There they enter a maze of deceit and actual fraud. Okay? This whole discussion of tradition in the Roman Catholic Church that fills in all the apparent gaps, the justification for the Pope's infallibility and his universal authority in the world, is built on fraud, abject fraud, and even admitted fraud. It took centuries of developing ingenious arguments to finally arrive at the theory that the Christ who had, quote, nowhere to lay his head, unquote, Matthew 8:20, who lived in poverty and was crucified naked, was to be represented by a regal pontiff who possessed more than one palace containing in excess of 1,100 rooms each, was waited upon day and night by scores of servants, and wore the finest gold-embroidered silk robes, that Christ passed on to Peter such pomp and luxuries, which neither of them knew, is both ludicrous and blasphemous. The glories and powers enjoyed by popes are not even remotely related to Peter's life of purity and poverty. This fisherman apostle said, quote, silver and gold have I none. See Acts chapter 3, verse 6. Nor were papal luxuries and pompous claims of authority over kings and kingdoms known in the church until centuries later, as ambitious popes gradually extended and solidified their authority and control over earthly rulers. Popes began to call themselves by such titles as Supreme Ruler of the World and King of Kings. Others claimed to be God on earth, even the Redeemer, who hung on the cross, as did Christ, asserted that Jesus put the popes on the same level as God. Peter would have denounced such pretentious fraud as blasphemy, and that's precisely how God's people should define it, blasphemy. Rome had been the capital of the empire before Constantine moved his palace to the east, and it continued to be regarded as the capital of the western half of the empire. With the emperor Constantine installed in the city of Constantinople, which is Istanbul, Turkey today, the Pope developed near absolute power, not only as the head of the Roman Catholic Church, but as the emperor of the West. He was both priest and king, arrogating to himself all the offices of Christ in counterfeit form. When the empire fell, it was the papacy which gave the fragmented remains its continuity. Thomas Hobbes would say, quote, the papacy is nothing other than the ghost of the deceased Roman Empire sitting crowned upon the grave thereof, unquote. W.H.C. Friend, Emeritus Professor of Ecclesiastical History, in his classic, The Rise of Christianity, points out that by the middle of the 5th century, the Church, quote, had become the most powerful single factor in the lives of the people of the empire. The Virgin and the saints had replaced the pagan gods as patrons of the cities, unquote. Pope Leo I boasted that St. Peter and St. Paul had, quote, replaced Romulus and Remus as the city's protecting patrons, unquote. Friend writes that, quote, Christian Rome was the legitimate successor of pagan Rome. Christ had triumphed, and Rome was ready to extend its sway to the heavens themselves, unquote. That's the truth of history. And can you imagine that all of these blasphemous arrogations and extrapolations can be regarded by the government of the United States as anything but the heresy that it is? But yet our government dances to Rome's tune. Our Congress dances to Rome's tune. So does the White House and so does the Supreme Court. There must some sanity come from this country before it's too late. And the only source of that sanity can come from God's true people, Bible-believing Protestants. And if they remain silent, Rome will rule unopposed in this country, and we will have forfeited the freedom that Christ gave to us. And what will be the price we will pay for showing such disrespect for the sacrifice that Christ made to liberate us? Subtitled Shameless Revision of History, Dave Hunt continues. He says, such was the ambition of most of those who were scrambling into the alleged throne of Peter and at times warring with one another to gain it. Using the name of Christ and piously making the sign of the cross, they labored mightily to satisfy their lust for power and pleasure and wealth. No justification for making themselves the absolute and infallible rulers over the church, much less the world, could be found in the writings of the early fathers, and certainly not in the scriptures. Therefore, the popes had to find other support. The means they chose was to rewrite history by manufacturing allegedly historical documents. The first of these bold forgeries was the donation of Constantine, which we've already mentioned. It was followed surreptitiously by the pseudo-Isidorian decretals, which were early papal decrees allegedly compiled by Archbishop Isidore in 560 to 636 AD, but actually fabricated in the 9th century. These frauds became the foundation of much of the quote-unquote tradition still relied on by the Roman Catholic Church today to support the claims, the blasphemous claims, the anti-scriptural claims, the anti-Christ claims of the papacy today. The donation of Constantine and the pseudo-Isidorian decretals. That's the homework for my listeners for the weekend. Study about the donation of Constantine and the Isidorian decretals. Google them. Read about them. You'll find out that the very foundations of the papacy are found in abject frauds. Fabricated documents. Forged. To make up the history of popes for the first few centuries of the Roman Catholic Church. Simply made out of thin air. Produced in the 9th century to give to the world the belief that there was such a thing as papal, as apostolic succession. That the popes of Rome could count their lineage all the way back to Peter. It had to be manufactured. It's admitted by the historians of the Roman Catholic Church that they were fabrications and forgeries, both the donation of Constantine and the pseudo-Isidorian decretals. Catholic historian J.H. Ignace van Dallinger writes that prior to the time of the Isidorian decretals, no serious attempt was made anywhere to introduce the Neo-Roman theory of infallibility. The popes did not dream of laying claim to such a privilege, unquote. That was prior to the pseudo-Isidorian decretals and the donation of Constantine, these forgeries. It is from them that we get papal infallibility today. And Rome still maintains the fraud, and the world believes it, wandering after the beast. That's all we have for today. I'm taking tomorrow off to be with my wife. I'll be back Thursday.
Blessed assurance, Jesus is.
If you'd like to get a copy of this program, you may subscribe at FirstAmendmentRadio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online.